Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome this evening. Before we jump into our conversation, I will remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it is a credit union, not a bank. It belongs to you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Or you can go on to steinershow.org and click on their banner, and all the information will be there as well. There has been a stream of attacks over the last 4 years against Barack Obama. We saw them starting in the beginning of the campaign in 2008, people in crowds, especially with Sarah Palin at the helm, yelling, lynch him, and other things of that nature. We saw what happened in 2010 during the midterm elections. The madness over the new Black Panthers, the Anchor Baby controversy, the controversy over the Ground Zero mosque erupted, Shirley Sherrod. Much as can be pointed to one person and one group of people doing this. Glenn Beck's obsession with Barack Obama's liberation theology and Barack Obama being an angry Kenyan anti-colonialist. Well, now we have this new controversy put out by the late, by Breitbart, who just died, his group, and put on by Sean Hannity. Which shows Barack Obama introducing Derrick Bell, one of America's great legal scholars, who just passed away in October, trying to say that this is Obama embracing another radical, kind of going after the reputation of Derrick Bell, but also of Barack Obama. And the question, we'll look at that. We'll look at his critical race theory. We'll also look at what this means in a broader context for this coming election and where America is headed and the racism that bubbles up in such a fervent way in our society. We're joined here by Sherrilyn Ifill, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law and author of the book On the Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century. Ta-Nehisi Coates joins us, senior editor for The Atlantic Magazine, author of The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and An Unlikely Road to Manhood. And a little bit later on, Horace Cooper will join us from the National Center for Public Policy Research. Sherrilyn and Ta-Nehisi, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Glad to be here, Mark.
And you all can join us out there at 410-319-8888. Sherrilyn, let me turn to you first. You were the first person I thought about turning to when we wanted to have this conversation on the air, because I know you would have a very distinct and important analysis of both Derrick Bell's work and what this attack means.
Well, so full disclosure, I knew Derrick Bell, and he's a person that I admire tremendously. I regarded him as a mentor, as many people do. There are scores of scholars and average people all over the United States who think of Derrick Bell as a mentor, and that's a testament to just what a generous, very generous human being he was. So I'm hoping we'll have a chance to really talk about who Derrick was,
yes,
because he's someone that people should know. But I also think that, you know, the question that you pose about kind of what this means obviously is an important one. I want to overstate it and understate it. You know, I want to say the attack is outrageous. The attack is very shameful, very unfortunate, and I imagine quite painful for Janet Bell, Derrick's widow, and for many of us who know Derrick's extraordinary legacy. He really is a giant in terms of legal thinking, in terms of being a humanitarian, and someone who really tried to understand and help us understand race and racism in American legal history. But I don't want to overstate it. I want to understate it. And this is not new. I mean, on one hand, we can point to all of the instances in which efforts like this have been made to try and discredit President Obama. That's really been the focus, right? So the reason this came to light, you know, Derrick Bell died the end of last October. He's a person who's been in public life. He has continued to write. He's prolific. There's a lecture associated with him that is held at NYU Law School every year. He's well known. So why now? Well, it's, you know, the surfacing of this video, which is supposed to be some kind of contraband, of President Obama introducing Derrick Bell at a rally at Harvard Law School several decades ago, when Bell was protesting the failure of Harvard Law School to hire or tenure African-American women on the faculty. So the point is to try and discredit Barack Obama, and the way one does that by the playbook is to say that he is involved with radicals to try and paint him as anti-white, to try to paint him as a Muslim in some cases and so forth, right? So in that sense, it goes with, you know, all of the pieces that have attempted to taint Obama in this way. But if we actually take our minds all the way back to Lonnie Guinier, the civil rights lawyer and legal scholar, now professor at Harvard Law School, who had been nominated by then-President Clinton to be the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, almost precisely the same thing was done to her. She was suddenly described as a radical, and her writing and her life's work were distorted. She was, you know, called a quota queen, and anyone who knows the complexity of Lonnie's thinking and writing and tremendous commitment to equality, you know, would not recognize her from the public presentation of her. And, of course, President Clinton refused to stand by her. He was spooked, and he abandoned her, dropped her as his nominee to be Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, and, in fact, said that, you know, he hadn't read her writings before. Now that he's read them, he too, is disturbed. So this extends back further, and it really has to do with a certain kind of attack on black intellectual leadership in particular, although not exclusively, but a certain kind of black leadership. And it would be interesting to kind of talk more about that. But that's what I think is going on here. And I think, therefore, it has to be resisted, it has to be called out, it has to be examined, and it has to be refuted quite carefully and quite powerfully.
Ta-Nehisi, welcome to the show. Good to have you with us, as usual. I appreciate you being willing to do this at the last minute as well. I read what you wrote for the Atlantic Monthly, and I'd like to have your kind of take, as also a younger intellectual thinker in the community, about what this means to you. Do we have Ta-Nehisi online? Are we having a problem with his Skype? We'll come back to Sherilyn and get that figured out real fast. Thank you. Sorry about that. Coming back to where we left off, why don't we pick up where, just to talk a bit about who Derrick Bell was, what he stood for, the man. I think it's important to put, because many people, especially younger generations, don't know who he is, never heard of him, and can easily kind of be dismissed, and people all of a sudden going to think he's some crazy radical who should be dismissed.
Right. So, you know, in many ways, you know, Derrick Bell was very old school and mainstream. You know, he grew up in Pittsburgh. His mom was a homemaker. His father was a working class guy, and Derrick was the first person in his family to go to college. He went to Duquesne College. He went to University of Pittsburgh Law School. He was a veteran. He was stationed in Korea and Louisiana. And he began his career as, you know, as a civil rights lawyer. He worked at the Department of Justice, and he resigned from the Department of Justice, actually. Derrick had a long career of protesting. He was not the person who got his and then didn't look behind him to see, you know, who else he could help. As a matter of fact, he regarded his positions as opportunities to open the door for others. So when he was first at the Justice Department, he was called by a supervisor who expressed some concern to Derrick about the fact that Derrick was a member of the NAACP, which at that time cost $2. So they thought that it compromised him in some way, and he thought that this was absurd, and he would not resign. And so he was essentially ostracized. His desk was placed in the hallway. He wasn't given, you know, good cases anymore, and so he finally decided to resign from working in the Justice Department. And so he went back to Pittsburgh, and there he met Thurgood Marshall, and he became a lawyer for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and he worked on school desegregation cases. He worked with Marshall and Constance Baker Motley and some of the giants that we know of from the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. For several years, and he wanted to go into academia. He attempted to many times and was unsuccessful. But he was finally, and Derrick talks about this in an interview, you know, he was finally hired by Harvard Law School, but this was in the period in which many institutions were taking a hard look at themselves. This is after Martin Luther King was assassinated and all of the riots and unrest that ensued thereafter. And so he was hired by Harvard, and Derrick said, and he, you know, has repeated this many times, that you know, he was the first, he said, but he was determined that he would not be the last African-American tenured professor. And so he was there a few years when he became concerned about the failure of the institution to hire tenured African-American women professors. Derek was absolutely a feminist. And so there were a series of protests. He decided to take an unpaid leave. And after he would not return from his unpaid leave, he was finally terminated, fired by Harvard. So what you saw in the video of a young student, Barack Obama, introducing Derek Bell was in the midst of that controversy. It was quite controversial in the world of the legal academy, very controversial among whites, also controversial among some blacks in the academy who thought that Derek shouldn't be doing this. There were some who thought it was paternalistic, you know, his attempt to compel Harvard to hire a black woman shouldn't be handled in this way. It was quite controversial, but it was signature Derek. He had a sense of conviction, he had a sense of what he thought was right, and he was willing to put himself on the line to do it. He then went out to Oregon, where he was the dean of the University of Oregon Law School, maybe one of the first African-American deans of a white law school in the United States. And he left there, actually, after the faculty there would not tenure an Asian American woman, and he returned back to the East Coast. He ended up at NYU Law School, where he taught on a year-to-year contract. He was solicited by John Sexton, the very famous, well-known, and quite admirable president of New York, now president of New York University, then dean of NYU Law School, and there he flourished. He flourished for 20 years teaching courses on civil rights and constitutional law, becoming a kind of mentor and leader to generations of white students who, you know, looked up to him, many of whom he, you know, asked him to officiate at their weddings. He had a very large following of students over the course of decades. He had a unique teaching style that he regarded as participatory, where the students were responsible for their own learning and where he really allowed students to kind of really run the class. It was very intensive work for him. It involved a lot of reading of small papers and so forth, but he was very committed to it. And that was the career that he created for himself. And during that period of time, he wrote a series of books and articles, and I'd love to talk about his scholarship because I think this is the part where people kind of get his what he was about fused and wanted to distort his message. But he was a prolific and extremely courageous scholar.
And I'm going to get to that. This is all really important, and then come to this whole issue of what is happening in America and why this attack, what this attack on black intellectuals and what this attack, kind of racist attacks, really mean coming from certain segments of the conservative movement. Not all of it, but certain segments. And Ta-Nehisi Coates, welcome. Good to have you with us.
I think I'm here. Can you hear me?
You're here, man. You're here. All right.
Yeah, I'm just making sure.
So Ta-Nehisi, what I asked before was, I really, as a younger writer and intellectual, you see this. This is something. What does it say to you? Because there are many people in your generation never heard of Derek Bell, but clearly see the attacks going on. So what is it saying to you?
Glad that I missed that first question and got to hear Charlene talk a little bit about who Derek Bell was, because I think it really draws out a point about this attack. The folks who are dragging out Derek Bell and dragging out their 20-year-old tape don't really care who he is and don't much know who he is. Just like they didn't know what Kenyan anti-colonialism was, just like they really don't understand what Islam is, or even I would go so far as to say socialism is. What these are words that they sort of throw out to scare, specifically, I wouldn't go so far to say white people in general, but certainly white people among their base. And there's been this running meme among, I would say, the far right, the right wing of the Republican Party, that any sort of discussion of race by African Americans, any sort of critical discussion of race by African Americans, is in itself some sort of great and radical offense, despite the fact that these sorts of discussions happen and need to happen in academia, in public schools, in all sorts of sectors of this country, and have been going on. But the point is to try to use all of these institutions, tools, in this case, actual people, which I think is most heinous, to paint Barack Obama in a certain way, whether it was Shirley Sherrod, whether it was Van Jones, and that is as some sort of, you know, black power, fist in the air, socialist, communist, I don't know, radical. Radical is probably the best word I can use to describe it, which anybody who studied Barack Obama and you know, read on Barack Obama is precisely opposite of what he actually is. For me, the most frightening part is really an inability to accept the broad rainbow and the broad perspectives that you'll encounter within the African-American community. So we have some radicals and we have some moderates and we, you know, have some conservatives. Barack Obama is not a radical, but it drives certain critics of him absolutely crazy. It's that they can't really accept this notion that he really is, you know, just a kind of middle-of-the-road Democrat. And so he has to be painted in some sort of way as somehow other than.
And so, Sherilyn, I think it's interesting here. A term has been thrown out a lot, critical race theory, when it comes to Derrick Bell and certain legal scholars. And it, when you read about it in the popular media, they clearly don't know how to describe it or what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And it's also a very complex issue, a complex theory. Many people have different ideas. So talk about that in terms of what Derrick Bell really wrote, what this meant, and then we can wrestle with why some people are so become so crazed around this issue.
Well, critical race theory, again, seems like something that most people would understand if it was, you know, presented outside this context. The whole movement was an effort by legal scholars, and it really only began to develop once we began to have a critical mass of black legal scholars in the academy, black and Latino and Asian American legal scholars in the academy. And when that began to happen, which really was in the early 1980s, those scholars began to obviously write. That's what scholars do. And in their writing, what they discovered was that there was a whole narrative that it was missing from scholarship about the development of legal principles and values. And so what these scholars tried to do was to interrogate the development and the practice of law from the perspective of the story that has been excluded, the perspective that has been excluded from our account of law. And for them, it was the story of race, right? And to try to bring that story from the perspective of those not included in the majority narrative, that is, of minorities, and to look at the law and to interrogate and to critique law from this new perspective, this new narrative that had been heretofore excluded from legal scholarship. It's no different than what happened in critical legal studies, which is really the movement that is the precursor by decades to critical race theory, which essentially tried to also examine, shake, and interrogate legal theories, legal values, legal scholarship from differing perspectives. The same would be true of critical feminist work, which tries to interrogate law and legal scholarship and the development of law from that perspective. So that's what critical race theory does. And so it was certainly controversial. It was mostly controversial not for its ends but for its means, right? The part that was most controversial, this is now I'm giving insider academy, you know, controversy, was the fact that critical race scholars, some of them, not all of them engaged in this, but some of them believed that you could do it through storytelling. And this was regarded as controversial because this is not how what legal scholarship looks like or sounds like, right? Legal scholarship is very straightforward. It's got lots of footnotes. It cites lots of cases and so forth. And to use this storytelling technique was quite controversial. Now, Derrick Bell, without question, used the storytelling technique. He had a series of books based on a character named Geneva Crenshaw who traveled through time back to the time of the founder. She was a black woman. And he engaged in a series of books in which she had conversations with the founding fathers and so forth. And so Faces at the Bottom of the Well and We Are Not Saved. And Derrick Bell wrote these books from that perspective. He also wrote a story called The Space Traders, which has been talked about quite a bit, which was turned into an HBO a movie. It was supposed to be a kind of a humorous science fiction take on race, but it was meant to really provoke us to ask some serious questions. And in the story, essentially, white America is offered, you know, all of the wealth that they need from aliens, all of the mineral wealth and so forth, in exchange for their black population. Would America trade away its black population for this wealth, right? So it's kind of tongue-in-cheek, but actually kind of, you know, interesting and important, and raised a lot of questions. Now, so that's part of Derrick Bell's scholarship. Let the record reflect, Derrick Bell was a darn good traditional race scholar as well, right? And actually, some of his most powerful writing, including his writing about Brown versus Board of Education and interest convergence, which has come up, and we can talk about that, as well as his writing in an article that I have managed in my nearly 20 years of teaching to teach almost every year. And it's called Serving Two Masters, Integration Theory and Client Interests in School Desegregation Litigation. And in it, Derrick Bell, frankly, got in trouble with a lot of the civil rights establishment. He talked about his experience representing black parents and children in school desegregation litigation. And what he raised were what he regarded as a set of ethical questions about what happens when a civil rights organization has its own sense of ideal or goal, in this case, integration, thinking about the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and when that goal may actually conflict with the interests of real on-the-ground parents in Boston, for example, who didn't want their children subjected to the kind of violent backlash that was happening. They wanted a good education for their kids, but they were not focused on the integration ideal. And so he wrote an article about the ethical dilemma of movement lawyers. I mean, it's an amazing piece. So he was an extraordinary scholar of all kinds. But that's the critical race theory piece, I think, that people, you know, are running with, even though they know very little about it, and when, in fact, his traditional race scholarship is really extraordinary and groundbreaking. Derrick Bell wrote a book called Race, Racism, and American Law,
yes.
Which is, it actually should be in every home. You don't need this just if you're a lawyer or a law teacher, but you need it if you're an American and you want to understand the history and the convergence of race and law in the U.S. It's now in its sixth edition. It's an extraordinary book. You will learn things about the history of race and law in the U.S. that you never knew. I continue to use it as a reference. I use it in my own writing. When I know something about a particular time period in the, you know, post-slavery period, I say, well, let me find Derrick's book. I keep a copy at home. I keep a copy in the office. I mean, it's an amazing resource.
Let me open the phones, and in a few minutes we'll be joined by Horace Cooper, who's adjunct fellow with the National Center for Public Policy Research and a former professor at George Mason University Law School. Number here is 410-319-8888. You just heard Sherrilyn Ifill. She's a professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, author of the book On the Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century. Ta-Nehisi Coates is with us. He's senior editor for The Atlantic Magazine and author of The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and an Unlikely Road to Manhood. 410-319-8888. And Anne, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I just want to say that with Hannity, they just want to live in, I guess, you know, a state of denial. They really don't want to believe that America was built upon the black back of this country. They don't want to face that. So I'm sure, you know, with the president being a young student at that time, you know, I mean, every student have a chance to open up their mind to what the world is at that time. And when you see there's a whole different look to it, you know, you are surprised. I tell you, I am very enlightened. I'm glad that I'm alive today to see, and hopefully that we'll be able to implement the program that all the black scholars who are dead and gone, you know, and who made it there. I went to see the sister who struggled for freedom, and she couldn't go home. What's her sister's name from South Africa? Lord, I can't call her name. But I went to see her movie last night. She definitely was on the forefront of trying to make a statement, not only for Africans here in America, but also those in abroad. I that's all I wanted to say. You know, do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Yes, absolutely, Anne. I appreciate you being, and I think that it is an important comment on where we were and where we are now. And let me get another call in here before the break and get another thought on the air, then we'll come back to our guest at 410-319-8888. And Robert, you're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Hi,
yeah,
Robert.
This
Welcome.
Is Robert Burke. I just wanted to say the professor was talking about critical race theory.
Mm-hmm.
I would add a little something to that. And namely that this has become an emphasis in a number of disciplines now. That is, there are persons in sociology in other areas, cultural studies, include, and even my own area, which is philosophy. So this is a much bigger area than probably the average person is aware of. As far as that nonsense of the Fox News thing about Obama, and Derek Bell. Should we even take that seriously? I mean, these anti-intellectual morons. But this is a serious matter. That's some very serious scholarship going on. And in a book, a collection of essays that I'm putting together on Dr. King, one of the contributors is doing an article interfacing King with the critical race theory of Dr. Bell, whom your guest is speaking of. So that's real work out here, and people are dismissing it. Don't know what they're doing.
Well, Dr. Burdick, always good to hear from you, Robert. Thank you so much for being part of this. We're going to take a brief break. I'm going to come back and wrestle with one of the things Robert said. Should we take them seriously, what's going on Fox News and other kind of right-wing blogs? We'll be joined by a conservative thinker as well. And look at what's happening with the change in America and what race has to do with it and what all these attacks have to do with people's perhaps fear of race and of African Americans actually being in positions of power. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are talking today about the controversy created by some right-wing commentators about Derek Bell and Barack Obama and the larger issues involved. We spent the last half an hour talking about critical race theory, who Derek Bell really was, why it's important to understand who he was in this kind of onslaught against him, but what it means in the larger body politic, if you want to wrestle with as well. We are joined, as I said earlier, by Sherilyn Ifill, who is a professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law and author of the book On the Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century, Ta-Nehisi Coates, senior editor for Atlantic Magazine, author of The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and An Unlikely Road to Manhood. And now we're joined by Horace Cooper, adjunct fellow with the National Center for Public Policy Research and a former professor of constitutional law at George Mason University. And Horace, good to have you back on the show with us as well.
Thanks for having me on today.
So this... When you look at what, when the question that came up in the last half an hour by our last caller, Robert Burt, who was a professor of philosophy, I think now at Coppin State University, and he asked the question, when you see these kind of attacks by people like Sean Hannity and others, should we take them seriously or just be dismissive? And I think that, and I want to ask you all that question. I mean, I think that the question to Ta-Nehisi is whether or not we should dismiss this as a real question, given that I think what it fuels is kind of a very dangerous kind of dialogue in America, what could be a potentially dangerous kind of push in America, and I wonder what you think about it.
Well, it would probably depend on what you mean by take it seriously. It probably does not deserve a 5 or 10,000 word article debunking Sean Hannity, but I take any sort of pushing of anti-intellectualism out into the public square very seriously, if only because that's the realm in which I work. I link this back to the comments, and really you could link it back to several comments. Just only a couple weeks ago, where presidential candidate Rick Santorum refers to the president as a snob for urging people to go to college or to want to, have some sort of higher education. It's this sort of sneering at what happens on the campuses of America, and this sort of sneering in general at trying to enlighten yourself, trying to know more things. It's funny, even listening to Sherilyn's explanation of critical race theory, if you look at how critical race theory has actually been caricatured, even in its most caricatured form on Breitbart's website, it just looks like American history. I mean, anybody that knows American history knows that white supremacy was in the law. These are basic, indisputable facts. And so any sort of urging away from a really hard look and an honest look and a truly loving look at the country and not, you know, a kind of braggadociously loving look that waves flags around but, you know, doesn't really, you know, want to look its country square in the eyes, I think it has to urge people towards a more intellectual approach. So I think when people who have a megaphone and speak to large sectors of America and urge them not to really understand what critical race theory is, but to just sort of hear something and, you know, make a quick judgment because it makes them feel a certain way, I think that sort of notion and that sort of idea has to be strongly and forthrightly rejected. I think it's in the interest of the country to do so.
Horace Cooper?
Well, let me say a couple things. One is I wouldn't quite describe the observations and recounting of either video presentations or essays by Derek Bell as some sort of caricature. The essays and the video presentations speak for themselves, and what they say, I think, are things that are certainly controversial. Some might characterize them as radical, but they, I don't believe, accurately represent the type of analysis of America that exists today or the principles that it was founded upon. And to the degree that it doesn't do that well, I think it is an inadequate analysis of how to describe American policy today vis-a-vis relations between whites, blacks, and others.
Sherilyn?
Well, so first of all, Derek's writing wasn't, at least the writings that have been referred to, he was not trying to describe American policy today. And I would really ask, I mean, I think this in some ways goes to Ta-Nehisi's comments. You know, I think the fact that we think that showing a 30-second video clip or taking one line out of an article or even one line that someone has said and saying it speaks for itself demonstrates how anti-intellectual we have become. You know, scholars spend years developing theories, reading, researching, and finally writing an article that may be 50 or 60 pages long and that may have 200 footnotes. Someone then takes a line out of that article and says, it speaks for itself. No, sir, it does not speak for itself. That's not what scholarship is. That may be what a soundbite is, and I understand that with all due respect to soundbites because politics is made up of soundbites, and I understand that. But Derek Bell was not a politician. He was a scholar. And so if you want to understand his work, you have to actually read his work. You can't go on a program, see a line from his work, and then say you understand it. So first of all, what Derek was trying to do in at least several of his pieces was he was trying to explain the nature of how race has interacted with law and the way in which we approach trying to overcome racism in this country and why sometimes our efforts fail. And our efforts fail, Derek would say, because we fail to understand many of the interests that are at work in perpetuating racism. This is not controversial. This is fairly well known at this point. When Derek was writing, much of this material was controversial. I talked about the piece Serving Two Masters. It was controversial because Derek was writing in a way that was critical of the civil rights establishment. When Derek wrote Brown versus Board of Education and the interest convergence theory, it was 1980, and this was the article in which Derek basically said that Brown versus Board of Education was able to happen because it was in the interests of the U.S. He said, you know, it wasn't just that people changed their mind and decided to be great people in 1954. We know that's not true because we know what the struggle of civil rights looked like in the 20 years thereafter. So we know that the work hadn't all been done. But what he said was there were a number of factors that were in play that allowed the Supreme Court to make the decision it did in Brown versus Board of Education. And the factor that Derek Bell focused on was the fact that the U.S. was in the middle of a Cold War with Russia and that the images of the U.S. oppressing its own citizens was very harmful to the U.S. in its relationship with the rest of the world in fighting against the USSR in the Cold War, and particularly in African countries where the Cold War was frankly being fought, right, on the terrain of Africa. And that therefore this image of Jim Crow racism was actually counter to the interests, the foreign policy interests of the U.S. I don't think you'll find anybody in the world of foreign policy who disagrees with that. Derek had the courage to say it and write it in 1980 when people wanted to get moony-eyed about Brown versus Board of Education, and Derek wanted to present a very clear-eyed analysis of the interests that were at stake at that time. What about that is controversial right now? Nothing, really. In 1980, it was controversial because Derek Bell had the courage to say it. So, I just want to kind of emphasize that what he was trying to do was something very, very sophisticated, and he did something very sophisticated in his work. He was not a politician trying to get Obama elected or to do a soundbite or to explain race in a way that doesn't alienate certain kinds of people. That's not who he was. He was a scholar.
So,
can I just add on to that just really quick?
Horace, go ahead.
I just got to throw this in really because it was directed at what I just said before. I think it's also very, when I talk about anti-intellectualism and when I talk about Hannity, I think it's very important also to understand how this began. Hannity did not begin putting speeches, Derek Bell speeches, up on his website, up on his show, to have some sort of high-minded intellectual discussion about Derek Bell and critical race theory. What happened was an attempt to slime Barack Obama and to somehow portray him as having endorsed Derek Bell. The attempt to attack Barack Obama, and they said this, it's about vetting Barack Obama, as they put it, because they believe the media has not done it, was what this was about. It did not begin as some sort of high-minded intellectual debate. It was an attempt to make a proxy attack. So I think we need to differentiate one from the other when we discuss this.
Okay. If I may.
Horace, go ahead.
It is possible to attempt to castigate participation in this conversation as if one side is intellectual and one side is anti-intellectual, and you can try that all day long, and you're still left with some facts. And the facts are that you can work with the clerks, the attorneys who file briefs, the organizations that participated in Brown v. Board of Education, even the survivors of relatives of the justices that existed at that time, and you simply will not find evidence to support this thesis that somehow it was the Cold War that was the basis or a strong influence or in some way a primary impact on the outcome of this ruling. What the case dealt with were the issues that came before that court and the issues that had risen up to the Supreme Court. Now, similarly, one could take a case like Dred Scott and one could attempt a scholarly dissection of that decision and try to come up with rationales behind why it occurred, but it still doesn't change the fact that there were actual cases that came before those justices and they ruled based on what were they believed to be the strongest arguments that they could bring to bear to the situation. We can look at both of those cases and we can say whether we agree or we disagree with them. What Mr. Bell did, and yes, it is controversial to reach the conclusions that he sought to do so, and to say that to argue that is to take it out of context, is not to take it out of context. It is to give it the justice that it is due. He has not made a persuasive case. He has made a case that still leads for more information, more justification, until it can be persuasive. And that is just a fact. Now, what someone like Mr. Hannity might do or another talk show host is a separate question to the facts associated with the assertions made by Mr. Bell.
So let me, Mark.
Go ahead, Shannon, please.
So let me just say two things. First of all, we probably don't have time on this show to do a whole historical analysis. We don't have time to read excerpts from Simple Justice. We don't have time to read all of the reports from the State Department about what the State Department was trying to do to change America's image of blacks and so forth in the world. We don't have time for that. We don't have time to do an analysis of Dred Scott. This is not about intellectuals versus anti-intellectuals. This is about the effort to try and discredit intellectuals by using the means of, pulling one line out of work and using it to try and reach political ends, which in this case was trying to discredit President Obama. That's what this is about. This is not actually about Derek Bell's views about Brown versus Board of Education. I really suspect that you probably haven't read the article. Most people probably haven't read the article. It's probably worthy of a conference, and I'd be happy to participate in one. The point is that the article was written in 1980. If it was so damaging and so distressing, I dare say that we would have been having a conversation about it long before now. The only reason we're having a conversation about it was because an effort is being made to paint Derek Bell as somebody who is radical, someone who is racist, and to therefore paint President Obama for having introduced him at a rally when he was at Harvard Law School 2 decades ago. That's what we're talking about right now. If we were talking about the substance of Derrick Bell's arguments, I would be happy about it. Let's have a conference about Derrick Bell's work. That would be wonderful. And from the grave, he would be smiling. He was not requiring that people lockstep agree with him or disagree with him. That's not the debate that we're having today. And that's what I think is the problem. We're making it as though we're talking about what was the reason for Brown, when that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the fact that Derrick Bell's legacy is being distorted for political ends. We're not talking about a valid controversy about one scholar's conclusions versus another scholar's conclusions. So I just think we have to be very, very careful about how we approach this. And it goes to your question, Mark, which was, why do we care? Should we pay any attention to this? And one of the callers said, yeah, let's not pay any attention to it. They're doing what they do. And my view is we should pay attention to it, because I think that the damage that's done to the reputation of people, the damage that's done to political debate, the potential damage that's done to young people who fear that if they say anything or write anything controversial or write anything outside the mainstream, that they will be tarred for it later, I think it's potentially quite damaging. So I think we shouldn't ignore it. I think that Shirley Sherrod was terribly wounded by what happened, by the distortions that occurred to discredit her and really to discredit President Obama. I think that Lonnie Guinier, for all the success in her life, was terribly hurt by the way in which her work was caricatured and the way in which she was discredited. So I don't think that there's no damage done when we allow this to happen without pushing back against it.
So let me ask this question of you all and see if there's a connection here. Maybe there isn't. And I think that I hear what our listeners think at 410-319-8888. The reason, I mean, that we had this discussion today, not because I think that this is grabbing the headlines. It is grabbing some headlines, which are some headlines I think that are pretty obscene about the situation with Barack Obama introducing Derrick Bell, and shockingly obscene. But that there's something a little deeper going on here. And what does it mean in terms of what's happening in America now? So, and let me just be very specific. You mentioned a moment ago, Shirley Sherrod. You know, taking out this little segment that made her appear to be saying that she doesn't want to help white farmers. And then she was fired from her job from the Department of Agriculture, a woman who's devoted her life to civil rights and was actually making a case that class was important, and she had altered her ideas about race in the South by working with these white farmers. Or whether we were talking about happened with with Acorn. And taking things out of context and editing films with Acorn, or Jeremiah Wright, taking out clips from his sermons and painting him as some kind of racist nationalist. And I think that this is – so the question is, what is going on here and why is it going on that goes beyond just what happened here with Derrick Bell and putting Barack Obama's face up on a video? A video, by the way, that was seen in 2008 that's been around forever. That some people are saying that Oglesby tried to hide or something like that.
Let's focus here. Now, see, I keep getting this. Well, first it was a characterization of anti-intellectualism versus not. Now it's a question of smear tactics against people versus actually delving into the serious works and contributions that they may make with arguments that they present. Bill Rehnquist was in his early 20s as a law clerk, and he drafted a document using a typewriter, something called a random thought on the segregation cases. Almost 40 years later, when he's being considered as Chief Justice, suddenly this is brought up, and apparently it's okay not to have a discourse, not to have a special conference where we go over the analysis and have pros and cons, just smear him. I'm amazed at people who want to tell me today how it's supposed to operate. It was no one on the right who fired Shirley Sherrod. It was people on the left in the administration that did that. It was no one on the right who disavowed the reverend from Chicago. It was now incumbent president of the United States who had sat in his pew who came out and disavowed him. So for me to be concerned and dismayed and shocked even that in the political venue there are consequences to the actions that people put in print or make statements, I'm sorry, I'm just not going to be able to be outraged about it.
So let me respond to that, Mark, with just two quick points. One is that you quite rightly referred to the confirmation hearing of Justice Rehnquist. Justice Rehnquist, when he was being elevated to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, of course, had a confirmation hearing as well. And one of the issues was this memo that he wrote when he was a clerk for a Supreme Court justice at the time that Brown was decided, in which he suggested that a separate but equal was not unconstitutional. There are real questions, and most of the questions really centered on whether he was truthfully expressing his own views, his suggestions to the justice. Or whether he was writing a memo that the justice asked him to write from a particular perspective.
Yes.
Derrick Bell is not seeking any job right now. If he were seeking a job, then all of his writings and all of his statements would absolutely be on the table, and he should have to defend them or rebuke them. Derrick Bell is dead. He died last fall. He is not seeking any position. Therefore, arguing about whether you agree with an article that he wrote in 1980 is irrelevant to the conversation that we're having today, because he's not seeking anything. The only reason we're talking about him is because he was introduced at a rally by the President of the United States at a rally that sought to bring greater diversity to the faculty at Harvard Law School. I find nothing but something laudatory about a student who would participate in a rally that would promote diversity among the faculty at a law school that only had one black tenured professor in its entire history. That's the only issue that really arises with regard to President Obama and Derrick Bell. Derrick Bell's not seeking a job. So I think the question of the political smear is right at the center of this discussion. The intellectual piece is what is being used. It's basically taking people like Lonnie Guinier or taking people like Derrick Bell, who've written thousands and thousands of pages, and pulling one line out and making a big deal about it. In the case of Lonnie Guinier, she actually, I'm just about to go there. In the case of Lonnie Guinier, she actually wanted a job, and so I've never argued that her writings were not relevant to the question. The issue with Lonnie Guinier is that nobody actually talked about the substance of her writings. The only thing you know about Lonnie Guinier's writings was her being called a quota queen. You don't know what she wrote. I happen to have read all of her scholarship, so I do know, and I can tell you, it was never discussed. And you're absolutely right when you say the people who discredited them, in the case of Lonnie Guinier, it was certainly President Clinton. In the case of Shirley Sherrod, it was the Obama administration. What it has created, and this is, I think, a key reason, Mark, why we can't ignore it, is that it has created such a climate of fear that the very people who should be standing up for the honor of these individuals, the very people who should be supporting them, more often than not will abandon them. And it's just very, very distressing. And that adds to the fear, I think, that many will begin to feel about throwing their name in the ring for a position because of something that they wrote 30 years ago when they were a young scholar. Because they fear not only that their names are going to be dragged through the mud, but that their benefactor, the person who purports to want them in this position, won't stand by them. I mean, the reality is the president didn't abandon Justice Rehnquist, didn't say, I'm going to pull him as a nominee because he wrote this memo on Brown. So I think what we're seeing in the modern day is it's creating this fear. And that fear is very, very dangerous.
Let me, before we go to the phones and bring Horace back in, Ta-Nehisi hasn't had a chance to jump in on this. Let me let him have his word. Ta-Nehisi?
I don't really know how to respond to what the gentleman said, so I'll cede my time to the caller.
410-319-8888. Robert, you're on the air.
Okay. I just want to clarify something.
Sure.
My attitude toward dismissiveness is more a matter of, let's say, a contempt for the intellectual and moral character of the persons we're trying to use Derek's, or use a reference between both Obama and Derek and Derek in that way. Derrick Bell, I mean, is a serious scholar. I wish Obama was as socially conscious as he seems to have been when he was a student. But I agree with the speakers about this. anti-intellectualism, which is usually a very integral part, especially of right-wing politics, not exclusively, but especially, is very dangerous. And it tends to merge with racism and nativism and a bunch of other things. On that level, I would say, yeah, we'd have to take us politically serious. That's true. Because this is used to discredit people. In terms of its merit, though, it's pish-posh, and so are the persons who are promoting it. But you're right. They can use this to discredit people, to intimidate people, and this is anti-democratic, and we have to uncategorically oppose it.
Okay, Robert, thanks. Appreciate being part of the show once again. And let me go back and have Ron Robin, and we have a few minutes left, and Ta-Nehisi, if I might start with you, just to what we were trying to get to, what I was getting to at my last question, which was beyond Eric Bell. I think that there's a tenor of discussion on the airwaves here, and sometimes I see it on MSNBC as much as I see it on Fox, maybe not as intensely, but it's there, and I think that there's a danger to what this brings up from the mire.
Yeah, I think there's an easy way out of this, though. Go read Derek Bell and make up your mind. I mean, I think, you know, don't take a clip of anything. And don't take anything you've heard me say, Sherilyn say, the gentleman say, or this show. It's true. People should go out and read. That's really all. You know, you don't have to agree with Derek Bell. And that's really the point, you know, I've been trying to make. There's always room for debate about, you know, was Derek Bell right? Was anybody right? You know, is any, you know, sort of scholarly writing correct? And that's what the Academy is about. That's what public ideas is about. That's a good thing. But to have that debate has to be rooted in some sort of information. It can't be, first of all, it has to be honest. It has to be honest. If we're going to talk about, you know, we're going to have an intellectual debate, we have to be honest enough to say we're having one as opposed to an attempt to score a political attack because somebody gave somebody a hug 20 years ago. But if we're not going to do that and we're going to have an intellectual debate, it needs to be informed. So I would urge people who are really, really disturbed when they hear the term critical race theory to go read some critical race theory and understand what, you know, they're disturbed by, or maybe find out that they're not, in fact, disturbed at all.
I think this has been a really engaging conversation, and I want to thank all of our guests for being with us. It's something we need to come back to and keep following, because I think we have to go beyond these kind of sound bites that we have in journalism today and kind of get into some serious discussions about what they really mean and what is underneath of them, what fuels them. And it's always a pleasure to have my good friend Sherilyn Ifill on the show. Sherilyn, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mark.
Always a pleasure. Horace Cooper, next time we get you on early in the hour, it's always great to have you on the air.
Thank you.
You
enjoy
to it.
Coming on.
And Ta-Nehisi Coates, keep on writing, and we look forward to seeing you again soon and having you back with us.
Okay, thank you so much.
Take care. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to jump into the question of the way we evaluate teachers in our city school system, highly controversial. We're looking for all of you to join in on that conversation. We have teachers' roundtable here from all sides of that question. On the way out of here, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. The number is 1-800-638-7781. If you're a first or second-time home buyer, there could be a house for you here in Baltimore City from the Maryland Mortgage Program. Call 1-800-638-7781. We'll be right back.